Continuing with the ATSC 3.0, here to present ATSC 3.0 and future antenna technologies is John Schaedler from Dielectric. John has been with Dielectric 27 years and is currently the Vice President of Engineering. After receiving his BS in Electrical Engineering from Penn State University, he began working for Dielectric Communications in New Jersey, formerly the RCA Antenna Division. He obtained his master's degree in electrical engineering from Drexel University. His research and development achievements have been focused on unique TV, mobile, media, FM, cellular, wireless, and many other special bidirectional and broadcast antenna designs. John has 42 issued and multiple pending patents. In 2005, he was awarded the distinction of joining the ranks as one of SPX's master inventors. Please welcome John Schaedler.
Thank you. Good morning. Yeah, so today I'm going to be talking about future antenna technology for ATSC 3.0. So you've been hearing a lot about how ATSC 3.0 is going to change the future of broadcasting and how it promises a lot more. More flexibility, more services, more robust delivery, more platforms. Well, all this more comes at a price because you have to deliver more bits to more places, which ultimately means you need more signal strength. So how much signal strength are we really talking about? Well, just want to make it clear that the purpose here is not to establish the next generation planning factors, but to sort of calibrate ourselves and put us in a ballpark and establish a range of those signal strengths that we may see that define different services that may fit within those signal strengths. So a good place to start is the ATSC A53 minimum standard, which you're pretty much all aware of 41 dBU. And that's based on an outdoor fixed antenna at 30 feet above ground with a 6 dB gain, which is actually a 10 dB gain on the antenna and 4 dB loss in the down lead. And it's based on a carrier noise of 15 dB. So first thing you want to do is if we reduce the height from 30 feet down to 6, which would be more conducive to a mobile situation, we have to add about 14 dB to that signal strength. Then we have building attenuation. Now that varies all over the place, whether you're inside a wooden structure or say inside a mall. It could be anywhere from 5 to 28 dB. I'm going to pick a number of about 8. Then you have the smaller inefficient antennas that are inside the handheld devices. They typically have a gain of about minus 3 dB. So you can see a difference between minus 3 and the 10, I'm sorry, and the 6, gives you about a 9 dB increase that you'll need. Then you have multipath. When you go from AWGN to a Ricean or a Rayleigh environment, it could be 1 to 3 dB. I can say it's Rayleigh, non-line of sight, mobile environment. So we'll tack on another 3 dB. Then you have a location correction factor. When you go from 90% to 95, or 50% to 95, which you have to tack on about another 9 dB. So what you can say is that the minimum field strength required for the next generation system to support a carrier to noise of 15 dB is about 84 dBU. So the first thing we got to do is get rid of the old school thinking of designing for coverage. Because what you really need to do is design for service. And that is, you know, focus on the population. How many customers are you actually hitting with specific services? Now, you can debate all day what practical services might look like. I'm just going to choose 6 that you see here that could be possible services that could be used. And again, it's more or less to establish a range. So if we start out with a deep indoor mobile HD service, say it supports 25 megabits, and you apply the appropriate planning factors to it, you see that you could be up in the range of about 95 dBU in signal strength that would be required. That's at 30 feet above ground to get the service that you need at the handheld device on the ground. Next, let's say we have a fixed indoor gateway where you take a antenna, maybe place it inside the window and use a gateway system inside the building. Again, applying the appropriate planning factors, you see you might need about 80 dBU. Then, let's say maybe you have a laptop in a nomadic portable situation, again, inside a building. And again, applying some appropriate planning factors, you can see about 86. Outdoor mobile with a much lower bit rate, let's say 5 megabits, you can see we're down to about 65 dBU. Outdoor fixed with a high bit rate, but again, outdoor, 30 feet fixed, you'd only need 56. And the current bootstrap, which works well below in negative carrier to noise, which is the signaling signal for ATSC3, in a rural auto environment, would require about 48. So you see the range of signal strengths that we might need, but how do you get there? How are we going to boost the signal strength in order to support those type of services? Well, there's different ways you can do it. One way is you can increase the beam tilt of the antenna. That's a bad choice. It works well in the cellular world, but unfortunately to broadcasters, you have a much narrower beam, higher gain antennas, and a much higher elevation. So when you do that, you basically get a bubble of signal strength over a very small range in terms of distance from the antenna. Another is you can simply increase the transmitter power. Well, as you can see from those signal strengths that we're talking about, that could be north of 10 dB. Not very realistic, neither one of those. So let's just cross that one out right away. Next thing you can do is increase the null fill of the antenna. And what that does is that saturates the signal strength close in around the antenna. And then you can add a single frequency network around the perimeter of your coverage area, basically facing in, increasing the signal strength everywhere else. And it's probably going to be a combination of those two, as you'll see as we go on. So one thing that you may want to consider in thinking about a new antenna now is future-proofing it for ATSC3. And as I go through an example, you'll see how crucial it is to be able to have high null fill at a later date. So one of the things that we're doing is we're adding a feature to all of our high-power antennas that we ship today. It's called Future Fill. And basically, it's a field-convertible null fill. So at a later date, you can very simply, and again, the key word is simple, in a matter of a few hours of rigging, increase the null fill of your antenna. So how do we do that? Well, I'm not going to go through the math here. It is kind of fun. But you, if you're interested, you can see the proof, mathematical proof of this, on a white paper on our website. But basically, by superimposing an out-of-phase disturbance about 5/8 of the way up the antenna aperture, substantially increases the first three nulls of the antenna. If that out-of-phase disturbance is 180 degrees, the beam tilt is unaffected. So basically, you just crank up the null fill, all the other parameters of the elevation pattern stay the same. Of course, the gain goes down because of the null fill going up. But this theory is based on an equal amplitude and a linear phase on the antenna aperture. Well, that produces zero null fill from the start. That's not where most antennas start out. You start out with a standard null fill. So we had to develop special illuminations that react positively to this theory. And that's the trick. Even though the solution to being able to do it is easy, the starting point has to be thought of ahead of time and incorporated into the antenna. You can't just go out and do this technique on current antennas that are out in the field. So how do we do it? Well, again, I said it had to be simple. You want a very short conversion time, very little rigging, and you don't want to change any other performance parameters of the antenna, especially the VSWR. So to get 180-degree phase reversal, 5/8 of the way up the antenna aperture, in a panel antenna, it's very simple. You just flip them upside down. So we basically incorporate mounting into the panels so that they can just be flipped upside down, and magically, you have your high null fill. And you gain up to 10 dB in the null fill and lose usually less than 2 dB in your peak ERP. In slotted coaxial antennas, we do it a little bit differently, but again, it's simple. There's coupling devices that are inside the slot. We basically just pre-drill the antenna so those coupling devices can be moved to the opposite side at a designated layer in the antenna. So again, a very simple procedure in order to do it. Here's some actual results of one of the first antennas that we shipped with this feature called FutureFill. It's KPPX in Phoenix, Arizona. It has a slotted antenna where we actually flipped the coupling devices to the other side. So what you see here in blue is the actual proposed elevation pattern that we gave the customer. The red is the standard pattern as shipped. The dotted black is the measured future fill, high null fill conversion. If they choose to at a later date, flip the couplers to the opposite side. And we see that we have a 1.3 dB loss in the peak, which again is going to be assumed that you can make it up later on in a single frequency network with the SFNs from the outside to boost up the signal strength in those areas in the outskirts of the fringe where you're losing that gain. Or you can choose to increase your transmitter power and bring that peak back up. In any case, we see an average of about 7 dB of increase in the null fill. Everything you see is that the impedance is affected very little. The spec in this antenna is a 1.1. You see, even after we flip the couplers, we're still under a 106, maybe 105. Very, very small change. So now I'm going to go through an example to show you what the actual effect is by adding null fill and adding SFNs when you're planning out an ATSC 3.0 network. So these are the planning factors, the assumptions that we made in the example that I'm going to show. But basically, we used a CRC model because it's much more realistic than a Longley Rice because it uses actual clutter data. The services that we're going to look at are the ones that I described earlier in the slide, which range from 56 to 95 dBU. We're going to limit the network within the current 41 dBU contour or 103 kilometers from the antenna, which is as is defined for distributed transmission systems by the FCC. As far as the towers that we're going to search for SFNs, we're going to say that all the towers in our search are available. We're only going to use towers that are located 10 kilometers within that 103 kilometer area because we don't want to get too close to that cutoff point so that we have interference issues. And we're going to restrict the tower heights to ones that are greater than 60 meters. Not very tall towers, but not very short ones either. And the programming tool that we use is Progera Plan. So the example I'm going to use is WNUV, which is a Sinclair station in Baltimore. And you can see the contours here for the 41 dBU and the 103 kilometers. The red dots are the actual available towers that meet that criteria. So the basic goal here is to boost the signal strength, see what kind of signal strengths we can get to support the services that I talked about. And we're going to assume that Sinclair is going to replace this antenna with a future fill antenna during repack. They're going to retain their full ERP and not change their height above average terrain. And then we're going to assume that we can strategically add SFNs around at these sites. So here's the starting point or the benchmark. Let's assume they didn't buy a future fill antenna. They don't have the luxury of increasing the null fill. And they just switched over to ATSC 3.0. What type of populations would be served by those services and those signal strengths that I defined. There are 7.9 million people within the contour, and you can see the bootstrap covers about 6 million, and all the way down as we increase signal strength, down to about 650,000, would see a 95 dBU signal strength that would support a deep indoor mobile situation. Now, I say deep indoor mobile, that's not doing 60 miles an hour inside a building. That's a small handheld device receiving high data rates inside a building. So that's the benchmark. So now let's say they do replace the main antenna with a field convertible, high null fill. And when they switch over to ATSC-3, they take advantage of that feature and they increase the null fill. So here you can see they started out with a standard null fill, went to future. This is just the overlay of the two. And this is the difference in signal strengths, or the difference in populations, I'm sorry, that you would see after the change. What you can see is that in the fringe, because the main beam, basically you lost gain. So in the outside areas, you lose population. So with the lower signal strengths, you lose about 174,000 consumers. But the higher signal strengths, you gain 440,000. So, you know, a better way of looking at this, or an easier way, is if you plot the population gained over the main antenna with standard null fill versus the signal strength, you can see that you do see this slight loss in consumers that are using lower data rates, but a significant gain in the consumers that would be seeing the higher data rates. So now let's say they didn't take advantage of the future fill, and they just decided to stay with their main antenna and add SFN sites around their main stick. So chose four sites. Basically, the way the Progeer planning software tool works is it starts out with an omnidirectional antenna at each one of these sites, and then does a power reduction in different directions to meet the FCC interference criteria. And by doing that, it comes up with the best theoretical shape pattern for each one of the sites at each location. And we assume 50 kilowatt ERP at each site. And you can see the towers themselves are not super tall, but they're not, you know, short ones either, 75 meters and 100 meters. And you can see the funky looking patterns that it came up with for each site. So let's take a look at this. Now again, this is the standard antenna. Hasn't been converted over to high null fill. The addition of the SFN sites that I showed. And what we see is that we see a gain in consumers that would be served by those different signal strengths that provide signal strengths for the different services. Overall of 1.46 million consumers throughout the service area. But you can see they're kind of bunched up here at the lower signal strengths. Again, an easier way to see it is to chart it this way. And you can see that we got a significant gain in the consumers that are serviced by lower bitrate type services, and a slight gain on consumers that are serviced by the higher bitrate. So, the obvious next step, let's say they did switch over to high null fill and add the SFN sites. So now, you can see that we gained 1.64 million consumers throughout the service area, but what you see is a much more even distribution in terms of how many people are served by the different signal strength levels. And again, just plot a little bit differently so you can see that much more even distribution. And you can basically say that, you know, there's a significant gain in consumers that are served by both lower signal strength services and higher signal strength services that require higher data rates. So now, the next step is, as you know, the planning software came up with theoretical antenna patterns, but they're theoretical, they're not real. So what happens if we actually design real antenna patterns to best fit those theoretical patterns? What type of loss in those consumers would we see with real hardware? So we used a combination of slotted antennas and panel antennas. And you can see in the red are the actual patterns overlaid over the best theoretical patterns. And in some cases, we actually had to reduce the ERP to stay within those envelopes. So when we did that, we placed the theoretical with real antenna patterns. We see a gain of 1.5 million consumers throughout the service area. And remember that with the theoretical patterns, it was 1.64. So we only lost 60,000 people. That's only a 4% decrease by using careful antenna design to best match those theoretical patterns. So let me move on a little bit here to what type of antennas would you basically be using in an SFN network. Well, as I said, I used both slotted and panel antenna combinations in the example that I showed. But let's take a look at sort of a comparison between slotted antennas and panels. The advantage of slotted antennas is they're much smaller in size, which means they have much less weight, much less wind load, easier to install. The other thing is there's really no connections inside a slotted antenna. Really, it's literally one connection at the input. Where a panel antenna, you've got multiple power dividers, feed lines, many connections. Well, more parts, more connections means less reliability. So slotted antennas tend to be much more reliable than panel antennas. Just to kind of show how simple they are, I love this ad from 1966, RCA magazine, where they basically imply that slot antennas are so simple, all you got to do is add a little bit of paint every now and then, and you're good to go. The disadvantage is their narrow band, so their channel range is limited. Slotted antennas are very versatile in terms of shaping the azimuth pattern. By changing the pipe size, number of slots around, where you place those slots in orientation, power division between slots, you can add fins and directors, and you can come up with all kinds of crazy patterns to basically shape the azimuth patterns to fit the crazy theoretical patterns that you're probably going to come up with when you actually do a best fit theoretical network plan for a single frequency network. Well, broadband panel antennas are also very versatile as well in terms of the azimuth pattern. You know, by changing the number of panels around, their orientation, location, direction, you can change the amplitude and phase in the power dividing network, feeding the panels, and you can also change the element bandwidth to come up with a lot of different variations in azimuth pattern. Again, very flexible, and the benefit is their broadband. So in situations where you might have a single frequency network where you might co-locate multiple stations on the SFN sites, panel antennas would be the obvious choice. And there's a third choice, which is basically a broadband cavity. We call it a WB antenna or wideband. It basically takes the best features of a slotted antenna or a pylon antenna and the best features of a panel, which is broadband, puts them both together, and you come up with a low wind load broadband antenna that covers channels 14 to 51. And it actually uses waveguide slot cavity technology. So the radiator itself is actually a waveguide. The nice thing about that is when you're talking about being ATSC 3.0 ready, you have to worry about higher peak to average power ratios and the higher voltages associated with those very difficult to break down waveguide. So it handles extreme amounts of voltage. So it is basically an ATSC 3.0 ready product. It's also the one that we used in Vegas for broadcasting ATSC 3 from Black Mountain for the tests that were done in Vegas. The one disadvantage, well, you lose some of the pattern flexibility. Right now, the ASM pattern comes in two flavors, a directional scall and a broad cardioid. So going back to the original question, what type of antenna to use in an SFN for SFN sites? Well, you have to consider different things. As I said, the ASM pattern, whether you're co-locating SFN sites and site sharing, and wind load constraints. Possibly panels can't handle the wind load constraints. The answer to that question is really no one size fits all. It's probably going to be a combination of slotted antennas, panel antennas, and waveguide slot cavities in order to build out an SFN network. So just to summarize, going back to the WNUV example, I made it a little bit simpler. I broke it down into only two categories, high signal strengths above 81 dBU and low signal strengths from 56 up to 81. So what we saw is that when we added the high null fill to the existing antenna and did nothing else, you see the significant gain in the higher signal strengths, which support the higher data rates, and a slight loss here in blue of the signal strengths that would support lower data rates. So then we added the theoretical SFN to the existing antenna and didn't increase the null fill. And you see the significant gain in the lower signal strengths and slight gain in the higher. Then we add the theoretical SFN to the main antenna and increase the null fill. And again, you can see that much more even distribution between the lower and the higher signal strength capabilities to support the different services. Then finally, we replaced those theoretical patterns with real patterns and only saw a 4% decrease in the number of people that were actually served. So in conclusion, we know that ATSC services are going to require a new definition of received signal strengths. They are going to be higher. We have to think about that. We have to think about that now. We also saw that through the use of SFN planning tools and careful antenna design, that you can achieve those signal strengths that support those high data rate services that everybody's talking about. And finally, that there's no one-size-fits-all solution for the antennas that are going to be used in an SFN. Again, it's probably going to be a combination of panels, slots, and broadband cavity-style antennas. So with that, I'll take some questions.
Understanding that we don't all operate in a market the size of Baltimore, and there's all markets will have their various costs, and if you subtract the transmitter and tower, in this example, approximately what would be the cost of the single frequency network antennas to accomplish this?
Well, I mean, I can give you some basic ideas of the hardware. You know, in terms of the tower leasing and installation, all that stuff, I mean, I can't give you a final big number. But, you know, 50 kilowatt ERP style antennas that fit the examples that I showed, anywhere from 20 to 40K in terms of the cost of the antenna.
On the null fill technologies, how does that apply to shared antennas with differential patterns between stations?
Well, it's only in the elevation plane. So the azimuth pattern remains unaffected. So in terms of different I'm assuming you're talking about a panel antenna where you've got multiple transmission line runs feeding them differently for different azimuth patterns. That remains intact. The azimuth patterns do not change. The one thing I will say is that all stations will have to get the high null fill at the same time. You can't pick one station that'll get the higher null fill and other stations that won't. So when you flip the panels, it affects everybody's elevation pattern, but their azimuth patterns remain the same. So, I think Rich has one in the back.
In synchronous radio, we had to put in time delay circuits so that each of the transmitted signals, be it primary or booster, roughly arrived at the same time at the receiver location. Is this a consideration in this variable network?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're assuming that we are not transmitting, or the sites are not far enough apart that you're outside the guard interval. That's an assumption here. So that guard interval is variable under ATSC 3.0, so it can be adjusted based on the spacing, you know, between sites. And it is realistic in terms of the guard intervals that are being discussed for ATSC 3 that within 103-kilometer radius, that's not going to be a problem.
Okay. Any more questions? I guess not. Thanks, John.
Thank you.